Welcome to the Jewish Diasporist, a podcast exploring the political, social, and cultural implications of life in diaspora. I'm one of your hosts, Ben Yanowitz. This episode is a little different from usual, as rather than interviewing a guest, I am one of the guests that's being interviewed.
Hi, I'm Mili Ominata. I host Talk of the Bay, A Moment of Truth on K-Squid, a radio station that covers the Monterey Bay Area, spanning from Santa Cruz to Salinas. I reached out to the Jewish diaspora after hearing some of the episodes and becoming a fan. I so appreciate Ben Yanowitz making himself available for me to interview on KSQD alongside Rabbi Chaim Mandel to focus on local Jewish life and the Tzimtzum community as a relatively young but quickly growing Jewish congregation.
From my position between our local Reform Synagogue and the Tzimtzum community, we looked at the ways that legacy Jewish institutions often fail to serve the needs of a changing community. Meanwhile, alternative spaces, built specifically to meet these needs, provide a positive contribution to the overall communal and spiritual vitality of local Jewish life.
Our conversation included the impact of COVID on the ways people practice Judaism, examples of Jewish law and ethics, what it's like to start up a new community, ways of increasing inclusivity in Jewish spaces, and why it's important to create opportunities for understanding leftism within Jewish communities, traditions, in the context of Judaism as a cultural practice.
Thank you to all of our donors, supporters, and audience. If you like what we're doing here, please rate our show on your podcast platform of choice. Follow us on Instagram at the Jewish Diasporas Pod. Consider becoming a donor on Patreon. And most importantly, share our content with your communities. Every donation, like, follow, and share helps keep us going and make the impact that we need to be making.
KSQD broadcasts at 90.7 FM in Santa Cruz, 89.7 in Prunedale, 89.5 in Salinas, on your screen at ksqd.org, and on your smart device, on our very own app. Our podcasts are available on all major platforms such as Spotify, YouTube, Apple Podcasts, and more. Without further ado, let's enjoy this conversation with Ben Yanowitz and Rabbi Chaim Mandel. Introduce yourselves briefly. I guess I'm just pointing.
I'm Chel Mandel. I use they, them pronouns. And I'm a rabbi. And I live in Santa Cruz. I've lived here for 4 years.
Thank you.
Yeah, my name's Ben Yanowitz. I grew up here in Santa Cruz, left for 5 years for school, came back. I'm a Jewish educator and community organizer. I also produce and create a podcast called The Jewish Diasporist, and also very happy to be here.
Thank you. So if you could just briefly sketch out your journeys with Judaism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, there's nothing brief about talking about one's mm-hmm. Jewish journey. And so when we that's like a big thing in Jewish community. We ask people, what's your Jewish journey? And that's like, you know, a long, long conversation. But I'll make it as short as I can. I grew up in the Bay Area and grew up in a Jewish home. It wasn't like the most practicing Jewish home, and I've become more and more into my practice and ritual and observing some Jewish law as I've gotten older. But I was always like called to becoming a rabbi as a young person. And it like guides my life. And I've been a Jewish educator for 13 years now. And I went to rabbinical school and got ordained last May. And I was in school for 5 years, and I've worked in and out of different Jewish synagogues in the Bay Area, Jewish day schools, and now I run and direct a Jewish community here in Santa Cruz called the Tzimtzum Community.
Thank you.
Yeah, I don't know if I can be quite that brief.
Okay.
So, I mean, as I said before, I grew up here in Santa Cruz, or in the Santa Cruz Mountains and Ben Lomond. And I grew up going to Temple Bethel, Temple Bethel being the main synagogue in Aptos that is serving the most Jews, numerically the most Jews in Santa Cruz, the only one that really has a significantly large building, so the claim at least. And I grew up not particularly religious. Like, we celebrated holidays, of course, with family, with grandparents, with close family friends. And when I say it that way, maybe we were more religious than I'm letting it off to be. We were very much Reform Jews, which means, like, we aren't keeping kosher necessarily at all. We aren't, yeah, we aren't super from, to use a Jewish inward, at all. But we became increasingly connected to the temple over the years because my dad is actually a, by hobby and also kind of by training, a sound engineer and lighting engineer. And yeah. And when, I think it was like 2007, 2008, they started doing something called Rock Shabbat at the temple, which has since become like the largest regular event that they do once a month. Some of the, they do like Rock Hashanah around Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year. And these are some of the largest events they have, where hundreds of people actually come to these. And you look at a regular Shabbat on the Friday every week, that's not going to be the case at Temple Beth El. You normally have, sometimes they struggle to have a minyan, which is 10 people. But my dad became the lighting and sound engineer for Rock Shabbat going back to when they first started. Initially it was annually, and then they started doing it monthly. And because of that, my family got more and more involved. I was going to temple school. I had my bar mitzvah when I was 13 with my twin brother. And then I continued through the, what they call Hebrew High, which at this point I'm now running. Well, not running. I teach for it. And then I actually was also very much involved going to Reform Jewish summer camp. There's a sleepaway camp I was going up to every year since I was like 10, called URJ Camp Newman. I went there. I actually did a semester in Israel in 2017 that I did a lot of reflecting on the narratives that were presented, and a lot of unlearning and relearning after that, because it was, I'd say, very propagandistic and one-sided in the narrative that it presented. And then I went to college, where I very quickly had someone call into the question the cognitive dissonance between my avowed socialism and the Zionism that I held onto at that point. And that really pushed me away from Judaism for quite a number of years. And it wasn't until my senior year of my undergrad that I like started to really walk back and reassess, like, in depth, the history of Zionist ideas and practice on the land. And that introduced me to non and anti-Zionist Jewish ideas, things we'll talk about, like the Jewish Labor Bund, which were basically the historical opposite of Zionism, like a secular, socialist, anti-Zionism, or non-Zionism, or just rooted in here, fighting for a Jewish future where we are, rather than in some faraway land. And since then, I did a master's in the University of York, was really connecting with Jewish community while I was over there, always on a different ground from Zionism at all. And then I came back here. Before that, I started the podcast that I've been doing, and I came back here. And since then, I've been teaching at Temple Beth El, also helping organize their youth group, and also just living life. I mean, there's only so much you can do while also maintaining sanity and working with Rabbi Chell and just leaning into the Jewish world here in Santa Cruz.
Okay, how do you work together?
Well, Ben and I connected a while ago because I run a Jewish Studies and Social Justice certificate program through the University of San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And I had advertised to different educators, and Ben got hold of it. And we had an initial conversation about the program and the interest of taking a class with us. It's an awesome program. And then we hit it off and just started talking politics and Jewish community. And I mean, we have a natural fit of, I think, shared values and approach to Jewish community and spiritual space. I do feel like it, when we're in community together, I'm like, I know Ben could probably finish this sentence. Like, like Ben's really like, I feel like we have really good flow together. And so I was like, I need Ben to be part of Seamsum. So Ben's been such an awesome community member and such a rock for us, and has been teaching actually in our Hebrew program for our youth. If you want to say like a sentence about kind of the orientation of like thinking from a Jewish diasporous point of view.
Yeah.
Ben brings a lot of great education to the table.
Yeah. One of the things I do for Temple Beth El is I teach Hebrew reading and writing. And that's not teaching Hebrew as a modern language. And this is something that I'd say Temple Beth El doesn't do as well as we've been able to do for Tzimtzum. Because the very first class we did with Tzimtzum, we was primarily a framing class. We taught three letters so that people could spell Shabbat. But other than that, we talked about why is it significant to learn to read and write Hebrew? And we were talking about how ultimately there's many different Jewish languages. Ancient Hebrew is not the same as modern Hebrew that was reconstructed in the late 19th century. Ancient Hebrew, you can use the Aleph Bet, the Hebrew alphabet, to read the Torah or to study it. You can also use it if you want to learn Yiddish or Ladino or Jehudi or all these different Jewish languages that have been established and spoken for hundreds, if not thousands of years. And we presented it as actually an entry point for future Jewish learning rather than an end in of itself. Well, arguably, as Jews, we understand that learning is worth it's for its own sake. So actually, like, it is worth doing for its own sake, but it's also not the end-all be-all. And I think that's actually helped the kids see reason and get excited about it, because it's not like, oh, like, often a lot of people are, like, complaining, like, why aren't we learning to speak it? And it's like, that's actually not really the point of what we're doing here. The point is that you're setting yourself up so that, of course, you can have your bar, bat, b'nai, bi mitzvah, but also you can use that as an entry point to continue to learn Jewishly on your own terms going forward.
That's really deep, that to give kids like a linguistic basis or view into one's culture.
Yeah, and it's not just to like have a bi mitzvah, bar a bat mitzvah, as one would say. It's like you have to learn the Hebrew to have this milestone, have this party, and have this celebration. It's like that's not a given in Tzim Tzum community. We're here to learn and like deepen our connection to Judaism and our Jewish identity. And if a student wants to have a bi mitzvah, they can do that. And also just say, like, with Tzim Tzum, Ben and I also have been doing work around coalition building of the Jewish left in Santa Cruz, and really trying to build on Jewish diasporic community in Santa Cruz and play with like a new paradigm of like, can Tzim Tzum be connected to Santa Cruz Jews for Free Palestine and connected to JAWS, Jews Against White Supremacy? And how do we come together in solidarity for Palestinian liberation? You know, and I think that's been something we've done a lot of working on together. So I feel like we're collaborators on like many levels.
Yeah.
I really respect the work Ben does.
So the work you're doing, is it all local or is it? Okay, you're nodding.
Yeah, I mean, together.
In a real sense, like, I'm also actually, I might have said this, I should have said this before, I'm actually also connected to an effort to revive the Jewish Labor Bund internationally. And that's kind of, that actually is an organizational effort that started beyond us, and then me and who I do the podcast with, Zach, who's a Polish Jewish socialist as well, currently living in Vienna. He also joined in on this because he has ancestry with the Bund. And we started getting involved with this and are connected. There's chapters in Montana and like DC. It's still an effort in progress. There's also, he's been organizing in Vienna and Krakow. There was actually, we're just recording this just after May Day, and he last year and this year, for the first two times maybe ever, helped organize a joint Jewish-Palestinian bloc at the May Day parade in Krakow, which I think is quite significant because
it is.
Has a massive and significant Jewish history. There's still a Jewish quarter that some have described as a Potemkin village because when I was there last in April 2023, there was graffiti in Yiddish that said, "Where are the Jews?" But there are Jews there.
Yeah.
And there's a lot we can go into about the politics around connecting to Jews there. And I mean, I have Polish ancestry, not from Krakow, but from that part of the world. And it's really important for us to recognize the internationalism of Jewishness. I mean, there is a Jewish internationalism that we are connected to, but we're also, I mean, when Chell and I are working together, we're also deeply connected to here.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really important for us to focus on building a thriving Jewish community here, even if it is, there's tensions and some of these things.
It's all interconnected, right? Like everything, like we're working on a local level. Ben's work, the Bund, is like national, international. I was in Krakow last summer, you know, connecting to community there. And so like it's the micro and the macro. And I think what we're kind of doing here in Santa Cruz is like opening space for different Jews to participate in Jewish community who have typically been on the margins of institutional Jewish space by just providing a space to invite people in. And these could be Jews who are queer and trans who haven't felt necessarily welcome or safe in mainstream Jewish community, or you know, saying, hey, we're a space where non-Zionists or anti-Zionists can also come be Jewish and not feel on the margins, that will actually center you here, and or inviting in, you know, people that just have historically been on the margins, like I said. So, like, that's the effort of, you know, what Seamsum is doing. You know, it's not always perfect, but we're really trying to create an inclusive space.
Yeah, I mean, it's also, like, in my practical work at Temple Beth-El, like, it is deeply, deeply local. Like, it's hyper-local, even micro-political, because we're talking about individual people who may not feel, like, they may be involved and connected to Temple Beth-El because it's the largest Jewish community center, the most visible, but they might not really jive with the politics that Temple Beth-El puts forward. And we see that there is a need, and there's actually a huge appetite for this, as Chell was saying, like, this community that doesn't force you to the margins, force you to stay quiet about your full self, which, frankly, like, I feel strange saying this because I'm sure people hearing this might be uncomfortable about my position at the temple because of how I feel about this, but I feel like I can't be my full self there. And it's sad because this is the temple I grew up going to, and I still feel like I have to kind of stay quiet, even if I am, like, the rabbis know where I stand, the kids I work with, I don't force my politics on people, but they know where I stand, and I want them to engage with the ideas because I think it's important for them to come to their own conclusions rather than anything that's pushed onto them at all. But it's really challenging when you have a large number of people who don't necessarily know where I stand, and if I speak out too loudly, I feel like my livelihood's at risk. Mm. And that's really sad and honestly not good for the Jewish people in the long run.
Well, not to put your livelihood at risk, but do you want to, are there particular issues that you feel like you can't speak about, or you don't have to identify them here?
I mean, it's interesting because, like, there's just passing, it's recording this just before it's ending, but there's an ongoing Zionist Congress election. And the Zionist Congress is an international body that's connected to the Israeli Knesset, like, as in there's, their representatives are the Israeli members of parliament, basically. And Americans have a chance to vote for this. Except in order to vote, you technically have to agree with the Jerusalem program of the Zionist organization, which includes a number of lines that do not feel even remotely acceptable to me. Like the idea that settling the country is a form of practical Zionism that must be supported. That to me does not feel like it even is acceptable to the traditional reform movement's line on it, but they're still uncritical about it, at least publicly facing, and promote and encourage people to vote in this election because it's for their own benefit to have their own representatives in this Congress. And or another example, there's American and Israeli flags on the on the Bima, the front of the sanctuary where we pray. To me, that feels like idolatry, and it feels really wholly antithetical to what Judaism should be about. But that's completely uncriticized. And there's other examples, but it's just, it doesn't really feel like as a space, a place that this sort of criticism would even really be received well, even if, like, I'm saying this hoping that I can start a conversation, because I don't necessarily think the leadership of Temple think that this is an unacceptable conversation to be having. I think they're just scared of it, and if you raised it, they would try to shut it down as quickly as possible.
And with that, though, you have to also take into account that that is the mass majority of all synagogues across the United States. That's not specific to being out here and being in that synagogue. It's everywhere, actually. And so there's very few places that don't have those kinds of stances or those kinds of signaling. And at the end of the day, I will say what we're doing in the Seamsum community is in no competition with anyone out here in Santa Cruz. We actually need it all. Like, strong Jewish community is multifaceted, and there's different groups that make up the Jewish community. It's never been monolithic, and that is a falsehood that we are seeing since October 7th, that all Jews think the same and feel the same. And all Jews for a long time have been in support of Israel. That's actually never been the case in history. That's never been the case for the last few decades. It's just the dominant narrative is seen one way in mainstream Jewish space. And that's tied to donors. That's tied to AIPAC. That's tied to money, ultimately, and power. So just to say, what we're doing in Tsim Tsum is just different. And we're really not just like pretty uninterested in mainstream Jewish space.
Yes. Just to add on to that, I also think it's important to say that there's actually not like a hard boundary between these communities. There's people that, like myself, are involved at Temple Beth El and also are involved in Tsim Tsum. And I think that's actually really good, because I think anytime you do something like what Rabbi Chell's doing of creating a new community, the established communities have a kind of like reactionary stance of, oh, you're stepping on our toes, so we're going to kind of see you as competition. And that's not healthy. Like, it's so important to acknowledge and respect the fact that there is overlap. I'm not going to name a name, but like when we did High Holidays with Tsim Tsum, there was a former president of Temple Beth El who was in attendance at one of those. And that's, I think, something we need to be encouraging, because in reality, Temple Beth El, as much as it tries to be a big tent, it's not serving everybody. And people are going to Temple Beth El and realizing that and feeling that there is a disalignment between their own values and the values that Temple Beth El puts forward. And actually, it's a good thing that they are able to be involved there and also have this other offering that's able to meet their needs.
So it's just interesting hearing this from the both of you, because I think in certain parts of the Christian community, it's totally acceptable to do what's called church hopping. Is that not as acceptable? I mean, I really don't know.
It's become a bigger thing after the pandemic.
Okay.
What you were able to do and have access to, of course, the pandemic, COVID-19, was horrible for many people on many levels. And one of the things that emerged was the opportunity for many people to peruse and look at different synagogues. And so you had access through Zoom to different services, even across the country. And that gave us all kinds of insights to what was happening in this community, And then you could be like, wow, I really like praying with this community, you know, or this is a different flavor. I never had that opportunity. Huh. So it was a gift, I think, to some of us. And it shook the bedrock for some synagogues and being like, oh, wow, like, there are so many other cool, interesting things out there besides the place I've been attending. And so my experience has been, oh, I go to all kinds of places. I mean, I'm the rabbi of a community here in Santa Cruz, and I'll still go out to the East Bay for a Shabbat or San Francisco. Like, I don't think you need to be loyal to one place. I think we get our needs met in multiple ways, in multiple places and spaces. And there's different communities and connections to be made. I think that's like the beauty. But I think historically it's felt like, oh, you have to pay dues and money to one place and be loyal to that place. I think generationally there's just a shift. I don't think it's like that anymore. And the funding landscape looks different than it's ever looked. And it's a true gift to be able to jump around. And like I said, like, I don't see Tsim Tsum as like in competition with any Jewish community out here. We're just doing something different. And whatever we're doing is bringing some people in. We just had a 70-person Seder for Passover, which was pretty amazing. We just had Shabbat at the beach last Friday with 50 people. And we're looking at, when we look at age demographics, these are Jews primarily in their 20s to 40s. And then we've gotten some elders who've bought membership in their 70s and 80s. And we have a family program with little ones. So we're growing. And it's just, we're out here trying to be authentic and serving people. And I'll just say at the, like, you know, in the larger Bay Area, there between San Francisco, Oakland, Berkeley, the peninsula, you have, to my knowledge, all of two places, maybe three, who are welcoming to non-Zionists and anti-Zionists, and who criticize and really question Israel in these ways. And we also are one of them. So it's like slim pickings up and down California. And even to LA, there's very few places. So I think that has allowed us to serve people who haven't been served. But I also want to just say we're still big tent. And when I say that, like, we are definitely focused on creating space for non-Zionists and anti-Zionist learning and community building around those positions. And if anybody who doesn't share that politics is interested in coming for Shabbat or learning or engaging, you're welcome. It's just we're flipping the paradigm. Instead of centering people who identify as being Zionist and support Israel without criticism, we're just flipping that. We're saying, this isn't like something we support, and we're really critical here. And if you can come be with us and try that out, you're more than welcome. I mean, like Ben said, at High Holy Days, And actually at the Seder, we hosted people from various different synagogues who wanted to try something different. And I think that's, again, really special to try something different and expand. And there, for me, I can't imagine if I was just still going to my childhood synagogue strictly and never left that place. And some people do. They stay in their Jewish community their whole life, and it can become insular. And, you know, one ideology is passed on from generation to generation. And don't get me wrong, I still would go home to my synagogue. It's not like I dislike it. But I'm so grateful that I've had experiences in many Jewish communities with many rabbis and many community leaders. It's expanded my Jewish identity and how I practice Judaism and my love for Judaism by really remembering and realizing that we're multifaceted again, and there are so many stances and ways and entry points to being a Jew. It is not one way, and no one Jewish community speaks for all Jews, and that's really, really important.
Thank you for that. So you mentioned you knew from very early on you wanted to be a rabbi, but what did that mean to you? Why did you want to be a rabbi?
Yeah, a few things. I mean, one was this innate sense of service and wanting to serve and show up and witness. I think for me, the thing I love the most and that I want to lean the most into as a rabbi is to witness. Witness people in their life's journey and life cycles. We all deserve to be witnessed and held in those various moments. And I felt just like, oh, I think I'm wired to do this, you know, like I'm here to do this. So that was kind of the core, and that's always been the core I come back to. But also as I started learning about my Judaism as a young person and into my teen years, I was like, wow, there's so much richness in these Jewish texts, the Torah, and values and principles. And this is such a beautiful, like, path to be on. The derech, the road, the, like, way of being. Jewish law, like, offers us so much. So much guidance on how to be a good person. And I realized, oh, I love this and I want to gift this and pay it forward. And this is something I can do as a teacher.
Can you give an example of what you mean when?
Yeah, thanks.
The law, yeah. Because that's
yeah, abstract.
Yeah, that sounds very abstract.
Yeah, okay. Thanks for asking. Sure. There's all kinds of ways, you know. there's like hundreds of laws and ways of being. And we could just something really, really simple, like, Lo ta'amod al dam re'echa. Don't stand idly by the blood of your neighbor. What does it mean to, like, witness others and witness pain and destruction and not stand idly by? How do I speak up and step up as a Jew, right? Like, we could think about this with Gaza and Palestinians. I am here to step up and speak up. You know, like, that is a teaching. We can think about haknasa orchim, welcoming the stranger, somebody who's different than us. This is one of the most mentioned Jewish laws and teachings over and over in Torah, I believe over 40 times. That's not there by mistake, right? Like, we're taught to welcome others, to be in connection to others, those who are different than us, right?
And to recognize, I mean, if I remember it correctly, the rest of that line is because you too were a stranger in the land of Egypt. It's not only recognizing that we should take care and love and welcome the stranger, it's also recognizing that we too are strangers to others.
And, like, how do you, you know, I think there's this thing for me, it's like, these are just a few. We're just giving a few examples, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I'm giving you some, like, the highlights, too, you know? Like,
sure.
B'Tselem Elohim, we're all made in the divine image of God. Like, these are just the highlights. So if you're just taking from the general highlights, and you're learning this and absorbing this, God willing, you're practicing this. So much we learn things and we don't practice and embody. But I think I realized early on, I was like, ooh, this is going to be hard to live this way in the world, to actually, like, embody an ethic and stand by it. You know, like, with Seem Soon, we realize we have shut ourselves out to about 99% of funding because our stance around non-Zionists and anti-Zionists and welcoming them. But at the end of the day, I'm really interested in, like, putting it all on the line to act in a moral and ethic. I'm not saying that, like, to be holier than thou. Like, I, you know, I'm...
Well, but you could, right? You're a rabbi.
Yeah, well, no, that's funny.
No, I'm just saying. That's a deep joke.
I'm saying, like, you know, I'm, like... I am not a perfect person. Like, I do all kinds of stuff that causes harm, and I'm always looking at that. I don't always speak kindly. Like, I'm, you know, a human like anyone else. And I really, like, I came to Judaism to live out a certain moral and ethic. And I know it's really idealistic. And maybe as I get older, that'll adjust and change, you know? But as of now, it's like, that is why I'm doing what I do. And I want to, like, spread that and, like, be in community with people who are, like, what does it really look like to welcome someone who's different? And how am I with that? And like Ben said, you know, like, one of our core teachings and ideas is, like, we were once oppressed and now we're free, from slavery to freedom. Cool. Well, we say this line every single Shabbat. When we make blessing over wine, we remember that we were once slaves and we're now free. If we have to do that every single Shabbat, that must be very important. So how do we live and embody that ethic of, we were oppressed, so let's not oppress other people? To me, it seems simple, but in practice, it's the hardest thing we could possibly do.
A lot of things are easy to say and really, really hard to apply. So thank you so much for that. I'm just curious. So at different points, you've mentioned that you're trying to do different things and seem to.
Yeah.
What are you learning by starting this new community?
Oh my gosh. I was like thinking about this recently. Like, I should be like writing a book on all of the learnings. Yeah.
Can I raise something? Because actually, there's something interesting about the Bund as well that we've been rebuilding that I think speaks to this as well. Because there's actually one pre-Holocaust branch of the Jewish Labor Bund that's still active, and it's in Melbourne, Australia.
Wow.
And we've been actually, like, last week we had a call with them because there's, like, little bits of tension that's have been going on. We've been trying to, like, build an international body with them going back a year and a half at this point. But it's been a challenge because we're building something new and they're continuing something that they already have. And that means that they're really concerned about all these relationships that they have locally that they feel, oh, if we speak too loudly in favor of Palestinian liberation, then we might jeopardize these relationships. And there's something that's incredibly liberating about creating something new because, and I think Chell was speaking to this when they talked about funding, like, when you're doing something that you don't have to be beholden to all these prior commitments, you actually have a certain sense of freedom that you don't have when you're simply plugging yourself into an existing institution.
I mean, it's a mixed bag, right? Like, to answer that, like, I think there is a certain level of freedom, which we've spoken about, which is the, like, oh, I get to say what I want, you know, in a sermon. And I'm not beholden to a certain kind of leadership or, you know, a Jewish standard way of being. I can really truly speak with discretion and, you know, in thoughtfulness of what I'm feeling moved to say. And that comes with a huge responsibility and a co-creation of the community agreements and how we're going to operate together. We spent months, we spent like a year writing our values. You could see it on our website, who we are, value statements. And we had to come together and have a discussion and lean into that. We've had to, you know, think about what's our statement around Israel and Palestine. Like, that was not easy. It would have been a heck of a lot easier if I just worked in a synagogue that already had a pre-existing standard. Of course, like, we're constantly creating and co-creating, and whose voice gets to be heard, whose voice doesn't get to be heard. How am I serving a community? Like, you know, there's a lot of huge challenge. And there's a gift of us also not sticking to any script, which is a blessing. We don't have to do things how they were done last year. We could change it up every Shabbat. We don't even have to be focusing on Shabbat in this community. That we could be focusing on something else. So it's all a choice. We have a really awesome leadership team that helps advise and make these decisions. I consult other rabbis in the field to constantly make decisions. It takes actually a ton of work and thoughtfulness. And it's really, really hard. And there is that gift of freedom to some degree.
I look forward to a book about how to start something like that if you do plan on writing something like that. So you're mentioning when COVID was happening, or rather COVID impacting the ability of people to sort of shop around.
Yeah.
Are there sort of lasting takeaways?
Yeah, totally.
From that experience?
Do you want to start and I'll jump in?
I'm actually going to speak to the way that COVID impacted pre-existing institutional Jewish life.
Yeah.
Because as someone that's been working for the last 2 years to help rebuild the youth group program at our synagogue at Temple Beth-El, it's abundantly clear the way that that has severely damaged the existing continuity that allowed the youth group program to thrive for decades. Because for decades, I mean, I grew up as part of this youth group program. For decades, you would have a board that would basically, like, with an advisor, which is my formal position in regard to this.
I had the same thing growing up, just in the synagogue. Yeah. I grew up in the same experience. So keep going.
You would have a board that would be, like, teen run, and that board would plan events. They would do the outreach. It made it functional. And for years, those would graduate, new boards would be elected. It would just be a cycle. And because that they were able to see how it worked, the kids themselves knew and were able to kind of just themselves with, of course, with an advisor's support, they were able to make it happen. COVID ended that. And this happened, I'm in connection with people in regard, there's NFTY, the National Federation of Temple Youth, which is the reform movement's youth program at a national level. And NFTY has, it still exists, but it is a fraction of what it once was.
Tiny.
They used to have hundreds, if like many hundreds of people come out every couple years to like a national conference. Yeah. And at this point, it's tiny. And like there is a NFTY region, Central West, that still exists. I grew up with the person who's now the advisor for the region. Also, maybe I shouldn't say this, but also not a Zionist, because there is a lot of people my age in the 20s and 30s that are not Zionists and still want to be involved in institutional Jewish life, because we do have some sort of fondness for the sense of community that it was able to provide. But the fact that the continuity was shattered, and it's so much more difficult, because I think a lot of people, one, they don't see that when they're younger, and two, I think just people want different things. Like, it's not 1995 anymore.
Amen to that, and thank God for that, because the reality is Judaism is just being lived differently.
Yeah.
And that's a simple fact, in that we have to remember, as we say, Torah, our holy book, only survives as long as we make it relevant. Judaism only stays alive as long as we make it relevant. And so the same thing happens to the Jewish community. I think during the pandemic, we had this like really intense reminder that Judaism can actually happen within our homes. People started baking challah and doing Shabbat, lighting Shabbat candles over Zoom, and taking ritual back into the domain of the home, which that's where it happened for a long time. And, you know, we have this thing where it's like Jewish institutions have kind of capitalized on them. Like, Judaism happens in the walls of the synagogue. These four walls hold Jewish life. Don't get me wrong, you cannot do Jewish alone. So we do need to be in community. I agree 100%. And I think it's valid and important that we still have these meeting spaces and that we come together for many gatherings and holidays and life cycles. So I'm not saying that we have to do away with that, but a reminder that we can actually transform and evolve our own Judaism in our local community, in our small havara, meaning like our friend groups, our family groups. And the pandemic was that reminder of that. So after the pandemic, people are like, do I really need to come into community to do my Judaism? Or can I get my 10 closest friends and do it in our local area? Which I think is a really amazing thing. So it's finding the balance, you know, after the pandemic. Some of the lasting things were like, wow, like, Jews can be connected again in the diaspora, not just in their local Jewish community. We can have different flavors of Judaism, and that I can travel for my Judaism. I can go into the Bay and go to this service. I could be here in Santa Cruz. And that also more individual ownership around ritual. Oh, I don't need a rabbi to necessarily do this. I can be in ownership over this. So I think, you know, all kinds of
things. That's really interesting, just the way you're describing it. Makes me think, this is not a great metaphor perhaps, but in the world of telecom, when you look at cable service or so on, right, they have that term unbundling, or people might use the word democratizing to describe like practicing Judaism apart or independently, sort of DIY it at home versus going to like a building or so on.
And also, like, just with that, like, the institutions, and don't get me wrong, some of these institutions are great and they've held us together and continued Judaism, and I'm not trashing them. I just think that we should critique and look with a, like, you know, a lens of critical thinking here, and to say that some of these institutions have fed us and told us, this is how you should be Jewish. You have to follow this way, and here's what it would look like. Some of us need that guidance, but I don't think there's a ton of wiggle room in some of those communities. Like, for example, of like holding a different politics around Israel. Then you're on like the margin of that. And I think really we want to bust that open and be like, there are so many ways to be Jewish again.
Yeah. And I mean, I would just say that COVID in a real way accelerated and made clear trends that were already happening. And like, I think it's really important to say that, like, this didn't just happen at once. Like, these were happening. It's just that COVID shook things up in such a fundamental way that those trends just kind of reached their conclusions. And I actually think those, like, mainstream communal institutions, whether it be Temple Beth-El or the wider URJ, the Union of Reform Judaism, to which Temple Beth-El belongs, they haven't really caught up to the fact that things have significantly changed. And because they're so set in their ways, I don't know that they will respond in a way that can really fundamentally change, that they can really catch themselves up and actually meet the needs of the communities that they're trying to serve.
There's a huge, huge gap, too, between, Gen Z and millennials and boomers and older. There's just like a huge gap in the way they do Jewish and experience it and politics and their lived experience, which is super fair and real. But it is a hard position to work in a synagogue and to be a rabbi in those places, because how the heck do you serve an older generation and a new up and coming one when there's so much change and advancement? I have a lot of sympathy and empathy. It's really, really hard to please everyone. Yeah. And I think we have to remember, we're not going to please everyone. I think that was something I had to learn kind of the hard way at Tzimtzum, was like, oh, some people might leave when we make a clear statement that we're welcoming to non-Zionists and anti-Zionists. Oh, okay. Not everyone may show up. And sometimes that's important.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Do you have any other thoughts about inclusivity that you wanted to mention?
Yeah, in terms of Tzimtzum, you know, one of the things is access, and I've done a lot of learning and I've been really humbled by learning how to create more access for all bodies and learners and people with different neurodivergence. And that was something early on, you know, somebody said, hey, like, this dining room, we were doing Shabbats in dining rooms and homes. Somebody said, this space isn't very accessible for my body.
Oh,
this space is too loud for my ears. And I was like really humbled and reminded, like, oh yeah, how do we design community spaces that are for different people? And that's been really hard and lots of learning. And I've tried to lean in and get advising from people in the community who have more expertise than I. And we can't accommodate everybody every time, we know that. We're in different spaces. So some spaces are quieter, more accessible. Some are noisier. Some have stairs, right? And that might be hard for some bodies. So I've been really humbled in learning a lot about access and how we create that. Also, again, like, for queer and trans people at the center of our community, as I identify as a queer trans person, like, pronouns are important. It's important to share your pronouns. It's important to not assume people's pronouns. It's important that the spaces we operate in have gender-neutral bathrooms no matter what. That feels incredibly important. And also, I would say, you know, more or less out here in Santa Cruz, we have a white Ashkenazi Eastern European community. But also, how do we welcome in people of color, Black Jews, Jews who are Arab Jews, or Jews from different parts of the world? Mm-hmm. How do we include that in our liturgy, our song and prayer? Yeah. And we're really fortunate to have an awesome song leader, or who brings in melodies from different regions to, like, try and open that space up. So, again, I'm constantly learning and humbled by how to create access. And again, like, sadly, not everything is for everyone. And so sometimes we just can't create that. But we do our best to really center the margins and bring those people in.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. Were you going to piggyback off of anything?
I mean, the only thing that I could really add is to just kind of echo what Rabbi Chell just said. I think really emphasizing liturgically, I mean, there's so many melodies and different things that, like, we might not think about. Or, for example, in Hebrew, we use one of the letters makes a T, but in Yiddish, it makes an S sound. And maybe mixing things up, like using this every so often. And it's strange because it's like, as much as I don't want to be Ashkenormative, there's also something that I would say is Hebrew normative, when we almost never acknowledge that that is a thing that exists, that frankly, as Ashkenazi, white, Eastern European rooted Jews, that's where our ancestors come from. So it seems weird almost to ignore that that is our own personal histories. And, like, for example, my grandfather passed last year, and I've been saying our mourner's Kaddish with the S sound for all the T. Oh. Not all the T. You can actually, if you read the Hebrew, you can tell which ones are the T and which ones the S. So kind of respecting that, but also beyond the Ashkenazi normativity, like the same goes for other Jewish, I don't know if I want to call them ethnic groups or cultural people with different cultural backgrounds, like embracing the diversity of Jewish life itself, because there's so many different Jewish communities and so many different ways to be Jewish that are rooted in different cultural contexts, that it's like really important to embrace and uplift that diversity itself.
And that, like, you know, you asked a question of inclusivity. So we're including different people with different identities, and also we're a community in diaspora. We are Jews who've been dispersed all over the world, and we have to honor the mixed multitudes and the beauty of the traditions in which our heritage, our ancestry was part of. That is hard work, because we're uncovering that. We're learning that as people who have fractured histories. So how do we honor that? And how do we honor our modern, like, how am I like a queer trans Jew, but also saying, oh yeah, I have lineage from Ukraine, I have lineage from Poland. Like, how do I bring all those pieces together? It's impossible, but we do our best to try and look at all of it and just name that.
Yeah,
we're not monolithic, and I think that's really, really important. And Judaism has never been Judaism, it's Judaisms,
you know? I mean, just to say one more thing, and I don't want to say any names or anything, but there was one member of the Tzimtzum community whose grandmother had passed, and her grandmother was from a Ladino-speaking family, and our wonderful song leader with Tzimtzum Or brought a song in Ladino that was hauntingly beautiful. That was a really special way to connect to that ancestry of saying, oh, this is a song that might help us connect to the sort of cultural spirit, to use a very idealistic idea. And I thought that was just such a wonderful way to sort of incorporate these things into the actual practice of sitting Shiva, which is to like mourn together as a community.
Yeah, thanks for mentioning that.
Wow. I feel like I need a moment just to absorb that. That just sounds like such a beautiful experience for the community and for that person who's experiencing the loss. I want to shift a little bit towards you, Ben. Could you tell us about your graduate studies?
Yeah. Great. There's so much background I can give, but I'll try to be really brief. So I was in the UK for a year at the University of York doing a master's in modern history. And I went in with the intention to actually study the international socialist movement around the turn of the 20th century. This is the period of what's called the Second International. And my idea was like, how can I study the actual practice of internationalism? Not just like the words they spoke, but like, how did these people actually do socialist internationalism? And I mean, we just passed International Workers' Day, which is one of the key examples of how these people did socialist internationalism, have demonstrations all over the world on the same day to show that we have unity all over the place. And also having conferences and whatnot. And very quickly, I was like, that is way too broad of a topic. You need to narrow that down. Uh-huh. And that is always, I think anytime you do a major research project, you come to that question of like, how do I do that? And it was actually only when I started to see my quote unquote extracurriculars as part of the study that I like really, it became clear, because just to cut to the chase, what I ended up writing about was how Jews who were part of the international socialist movement saw their Jewishness relating to this broader politics of building a world that all people have freedom, justice, equality, and a world in which there is no more oppression for anyone. But the way it kind of came to that was by actually engaging in Jewish student politics. I met Zach, who I've been doing the Jewish Diasporist podcast with. You can check out our first couple episodes to get the story of what we did around starting it. But ultimately, I went to Poland with Zach in April 2023. We went there to honor the 80th anniversary of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. Of course, he speaks Polish, so we were able to do some really, really meaningful explorations of engaging with people in the communities there. I met people who, had I spoke Yiddish, I would have been able to speak to them directly, because I met people who spoke Polish and Yiddish, but no English. But I don't speak Yiddish because my great-grandparents' generation decided not to pass that down because they wanted a language that they could speak to each other without having the kids know. Kind of a funny little thing. But it's kind of also sad because I felt like personally I didn't really realize or really internalize that actually that is the language of my ancestors, not Hebrew. Even though it's written in the same alphabet, it's a completely different language. And I went there for that, and while I was there I had an address that was in this town called Radimno. That my great-grandfather left in 1929. And this was the last of my ancestors to leave the old country. And we had this this address with the... It was taken from my great-grandfather when he was still with us. He wrote it. It was on the street Ruska Elitsa, Russia Street. And surprising, in Eastern Poland, there's no longer a street called Russia Street. But I went with Zach to the town records office, and we were able to ask them what street used to be called Ruska Elitsa, and they told us. And we actually found the house that my great-grandfather left in 1929, and it's still standing.
Wow.
Which
wow.
to me, that was like, oh, this is actually the ground that my great-grandfather played on. This is the ground that he had his first steps on. This is the place that he was with family. And that was, to me, something that was deeply moving in a way that when I went to Israel in 2017 for a semester, I had kind of, like, placeboed myself into feeling, but it wasn't the same sense of, like, oh, no, this is actually the soil, like, the direct place that he was from. And that was really profound in terms of connecting to another place. And then the next month, I actually went to Palestine with the Center for Jewish Nonviolence, a delegation, in May 2023. And between those two trips, like, we did a lot of political education stuff, but we also took part in a few different actions. One was a road blockade on the main north-south highway coming up from the settlements in the West Bank and the South on Jerusalem Day, which is the day that they conquered East Jerusalem and the West Bank in 67. And we also spent a few days in Masafer Yatta in the South Hebron Hills, doing just being with the community, but we also actually helped set up, our group was split between two villages. We set up two different playgrounds in these communities, because these communities are very small. They're about 100 people or so each, and they're like extended families. And I would say the average age in the community that we visited or that I spent time in was probably 12 or 13, because it was so many young children. And I could really go, I could spend an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours talking about this, but being in that community and frankly welcomed with such joy. I don't speak any Arabic. I wish I did. But when we got there, the children were so happy to have us there and so excited to welcome us and to sit with us and smile and laugh with us and to play on the playground and push us in the swings. Like, I actually was pushing a kid in the swings, and they were like, no, I want to push you in the swings.
Oh, wow.
Which was cute. Deeply, deeply moving. And it was actually while I was in Masafer Yatta that I was like, oh, I'm doing Jewish internationalism. Like, why don't I narrow my dissertation topic by focusing on how Jews themselves have engaged with the practice of socialist internationalism? And I was looking at that. Basically, it ended up being like a historical ethnography of left-wing Jews from the late 1800s to the early 1900s, really decentering Zionism entirely to understand, ask the question of, like, how did Jews see their Jewishness interacting with the future socialist society that they're working towards? And that took many different directions, from a socialist Zionism that I think we can see doesn't really have any basis in reality at this point, to what I was calling an assimilationist communism, which was like the traditional Marxist approach of saying the world in which we're building isn't going to have religion at all. So because Judaism is a religion, then there's not going to be a Jewish future, and therefore we should just assimilate into the countries that we are. And then there was a third approach that personally resonates the most to me, which I was calling diasporism. And this was, of course, we're oversimplifying. Anytime you schematize something like this, it's going to be an oversimplification. But this third approach was perhaps the most diverse, because you had organizations like the Bund, who were very much rooting themselves in Eastern Europe and saying, this is actually our homeland, and our Jewish future is going to be rooted here in solidarity and partnership with all the other nationalities and peoples who also call this their homeland. But you also have more liberal diasporists like Simon Dubnov, who had this idea of diaspora nationalism, which was this idea of building a world nation in which American Jews or Eastern European Jews or North African Jews, Middle Eastern Jews would each have their own Jewish assemblies that would be part of a broader international Jewish assembly that would speak, that would have Jewish self-determination that is not national self-determination as it's modernly conceived most commonly. It's not necessarily territorial. So that's what I was ultimately studying. And I would say my podcast actually, I mean, it did emerge alongside the research I was doing. And ultimately, like, it's still ongoing. Like, I've been considering potentially doing a PhD in Jewish studies in order to kind of draw these things all together, because I was looking at this question primarily from the UK point of view, which was, like, hundreds of thousands of Jews came to the UK, many hundreds of thousands also left from the UK. It was both a transit point in which many, like, 2 million people came to the US, only about 500,000 ended up staying in the UK. So I was looking at it from a pretty untraditional geographic lens, but it did help me kind of say something new about the way in which labor histories in particular, because there were dozens if not hundreds of Jewish trade unions that took part in strikes and led strikes that were part of a broader transnational social movement.
So why is it important for Jews to know about socialist and labor traditions within the Jewish culture?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important on the surface. The answer is because it's not taught in most traditional Jewish educations you're going to get. I mean, we've spent most of this conversation we've had so far talking about Judaism as a religious practice, but it's also a cultural practice. It's also, like, I'm hesitant to use the word nation because I think actually Jews are many different ethnic groups and we don't fit so neatly into that category. But it's important because Jews have been on the forefront of labor and socialist movements for the entire history of the labor and socialist movement, from the mid-19th century when this movement really started to take form onward. And there wasn't necessarily a Jewish socialist movement as such until the 1870s, but from the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s, and into the early 1900s, that was a substantial part of Jewish politics, if not the dominant part of Jewish politics. And I think it's really important to reclaim our connection to these movements, because right now, especially, we're seeing the efforts to, I mean, frankly, look at the way that the Nazis and the whole Judeo-Bolshevik conspiracy theory, which was the idea that Jews are responsible for the Bolshevik Revolution and also for capitalism. Like, I think it's really important to recognize that there is a reason that Jews have been part of these movements, because at that point we were undeniably an oppressed people, but also because we were seeing, I mean, there's a grounding of seeing this messianic future, this idea of a world in which we beat our swords into plowshares. We no longer wage war on each other. We actually care, a universal community of siblings, we're all one people. And that has been a longing within the Jewish tradition, to go back to a religious sense. But many Jews saw communism as a secularized messianism of, like, we actually, it's our job to build that world. We can't wait for some messianic figure to save us. We collectively have to bring that about. And I actually see it as deeply connected to that Jewish tradition of messianism to call for a social transformation. Mm-hmm. I feel like I'm tripping over my words here almost.
You're good. But, you're good.
But ultimately, I think it's important to know and acknowledge and study this, because it's a history that was so influential within the Jewish world that's been suppressed, and it still has roots and it still has reasons and importance to be brought back today. I mean, it's hard to even conceive of what a Jewish labor movement would look like in the 21st century. Especially when Jews are stereotyped so often not as workers, but as capitalists, as owners. And I think it's really important to reclaim that. And I mean, Jews are workers. Jews are out doing things. Maybe they don't think of themselves as Jewish workers per se, because that's not a category people talk about so much these days. But it's something that I think has important implications about the future for Jewish people, because so often Zionists like to imagine that there's only one Jewish future, and it's the future of a Jewish nation state. But what if the other, what if there is a Jewish future that is tied up with the liberation of all humanity from the shackles of oppression, capitalism, racism? And that's something that we should be doing as Jews.
We have, just to like add, you know, like in Tzimtzum community, a handful of our members are connected to the DSA. They're connected to socialist movements. And, you know, just the other day, you know, people from Tzimtzum are on campus protesting the rent increases for, you know, student staff housing, you know, and all of these things. And like a lot of our people have been involved in these movements and protests on campus over the years. And right now we have Rebecca Gross, who's a PhD student, teaching a multi-part series through Tzimtzum on anti-Zionist literature and histories, and bringing in, you know, texts connected to socialist movement, Marxism, and all of these things. So, you know, I see like Tzimtzum as like a home for many of these people, and yeah, this education, and trying to not just do religious spiritual life, which we do, and like bring in the political and bring in the other cultural pieces of Judaism and histories. It feels like really important, and it's been like such a gift to have a lot of these academics and thinkers in our community bringing this knowledge, you know, like Ben or Rebecca Gross and others.
Thank you. When you say on campus, you mean the UC Santa Cruz campus? And I think K-Squid has had Rebecca Gross on here to talk about, I guess it's the UAW.
Yep. Mm-hmm. She's very, very involved.
8211.
Yeah,
I'm sorry, 4811. So I've asked you a bunch of stuff. Is there anything I haven't asked you yet that you'd want to discuss? I mean, what would you like people to take away from this conversation?
Yeah, I mean, I think really, again, I've said it multiple times, but Jewish community is diverse, it's multifaceted, it's layered, and that's the beauty in it. And we shouldn't try and make Jews all uniform in one way. That's not how it's been. It'll never be that way. And once we can see the beauty in multiple ways of doing Jewish and being Jewish, like, I think we're thriving. And it's hard to do that. It's hard to be in community with people who have difference. You know, it's so much easier to walk away or to find a community that is only one way of being. So we may center progressive Jews and marginalized identities, but we're also in conversation, you know, and trying to expand and grow. And I hope that, you know, we could be a place for the activists in Santa Cruz to come and just be and not, and like to recharge, you know, and also non-Jews. We do have non-Jews showing up to our Shabbat services, like queer and trans people who are like, this just feels like the spiritual space I need right now. Or people showing up and saying, wow, like, this is fun. Like, I get to like learn a little bit, have some spiritual connection, sing a little, and make new friends and community members. Like, we're humans, we need connection. And, you know, in the time we're in with the Trump administration, like, we need community more now than ever. So my hope is that Tzimtzum community can be a place of reprieve and renewal, and also like learning and challenging and growth, like all of the things that people would seek us and show up and just like enter in, give it a go. Even if you're like a little nervous or like, I don't know if this is my politics, that's a good thing to be in a space where you have to stretch and grow. It's a good thing to be in community with those who might know more than you, you know? It's good to be in a community with those who don't know anything about Judaism, right? We want that. And I hope at the end of the day, we could serve those who just need to be witnessed and seen. And that's kind of the goal and the mission of this work. You know, we're not funded. We do have membership. We have 70 paying members right now. We have served over 500 unique individuals over 2.5 years. We have people who do come out from the Greater Bay Area, from Monterey, from Carmel, from Half Moon Bay, to come to our services and gatherings. That's like magic to me. I still can't believe it. Every time, like I said last Friday, I looked out to 50 people and was like, this is the dream. Thank you for being here. But I say that to say, like, we're not funded. That's why I work a full-time job at the University of San Francisco in the Jewish Studies and Social Justice program. And I teach there, which I feel really grateful for. And it's a huge lift to like run a community and direct a community and also work full-time. So I think it's really important to fund these projects. And, you know, individual donors trying to get grants and all those things. And I'll say that something I love about the progressive left is the desire to create new paradigms and build new worlds, but that takes capital. And that's just the reality of it. Mm-hmm. And my kind of ongoing joke is to the anti-Zionist community, okay, you all keep asking synagogues to be anti-Zionist. They're not going to do that. So then you want alternative spaces like Simsum. Well, you need to fund us. So I'm very, very clear, like, you know, all of us have to buy into what we want to see. And that's why we launched membership, and it's worked. Like, we have people paying. We do have donations coming in, which is awesome. And it allows us to hire people like Ben to teach Hebrew, to hire our song leader, to hire people to do this work. But we're nowhere nearly at the amount of money we need. And so I encourage people who want to see alternative Jewish communities and or communities that can speak up for progressive values and ways of being to like come support, whether that's financially or volunteer, or like we've had a lot of people offer like business consulting support. You know, I've had people come in and say, I'll build your website for free. We just want to support this. So I have no shame in asking for help, and we really need it to keep doing what we're doing and to serve queer and trans people and people on the margins in Santa Cruz.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Ben.
I would just say that this is what Jewish self-determination looks like. At the end of the day, we are building our own platforms, our own places for us to be heard and to gather people that align with the sort of things that we're doing into. Because we're not going to be helped by claiming that there's a state that speaks for all of our people. And again, I'm hesitant to use the word our people here because I don't necessarily feel that my people are Israelis, because I'm not an Israeli. I'm an American Ashkenazi Jew. And ultimately, I guess the other piece of that is that our mainstream institutions are, and I say this with sorrow in a real sense, they're failing us. They're allowing this state that is actively waging atrocities every single day to claim to speak for us. And that is actively hurting the Jewish people. That is creating anti-Semitism. And if we want to have a future that is free of all forms of hate, we need to separate ourselves from that yesterday, frankly. It's not too late to change years, but we can't continue to act like things are still the 1970s. We can't just pretend that there hasn't been an occupation of the West Bank for almost 60 years at this point. And that's just the West Bank. We're not talking about the Nakba in 48 and all the things that come out of that. And I think it's so important for us to recognize that Jewish politics at the same time shouldn't just be seen as the question of Israel-Palestine and anti-Semitism. There's also questions of reviving Jewish communities around the world. I mean, I want to actually end on this point because I think it's something that most people don't realize, and it kind of is an example of how our Jewish communities should be doing more internationally. The Reform community in Krakow, which my podcasting co-host Zach grew up as part of, he was actually the first Reform bar mitzvah in Krakow since the Holocaust.
Wow.
Not the first bi mitzvah, there was a bat mitzvah the year before. But the Reform community there does not have access to the traditional Reform synagogue in Krakow, which is called the Tempel Synagogue, which as a Jewish tourist that visited Krakow when I was 17, we had the rights to visit there. We had the rights to have a service in this synagogue, because when they transferred the Jewish communal properties over to the quote-unquote Jewish community in the 1990s, it was transferred to the Orthodox body. And they don't respect the Reform movement. And because of that, the Reform synagogue or the Reform congregation in Krakow meets in like a back room of like, I actually don't want to say this because I don't remember exactly. I've been there, but it's not like a permanent space that they can celebrate and invite people into. It's like a small gathering space that they're able to use. But there is a pre-Holocaust large synagogue in Krakow, and the Reform movement to which this congregation is part of doesn't do anything to support these people. And, like, if it were up to me, the URJ would do a lot to show that they care about Jews around the world by actively fighting for this congregation's right to use the synagogue in their own city that they should have a right to use, because their ancestors, who were in the same city, built the synagogue. But because it just shows that there's so many more things that we as Jews should be doing to support people around the world, to use the word co-religionists around the world, that they just aren't. And I actually think it's the reason I'm saying this now is because I actually want us to be building pressure to get the URJ to use some of their funding to either get it from the Orthodox authorities in Krakow, or to simply pressure them to let this community actually have the right to use a synagogue that, by all logical explanations, should be theirs in the first place.
So how can people follow you?
Yeah.
Do you both have social media?
Yeah, it'll be, you could just go online and Seem community and type it in Santa Cruz, and we have a website.
Do you
want to
spell it out for them?
Yeah, TZIMTZUM, Team Zoom Community. You can find us on Instagram, Team Zoom Community, and you can reach us in both of those places. The way to know what we're doing and what's going on is we have an overview on our website, and on Instagram we post stuff, but you have to get on the newsletter to know what's happening, all of that, and then you can look into membership from there. We welcome everybody in. You don't have to be a member to come to something, but you know that is helpful to us. Yeah, that is how you can find Team Zoom Community, and we do Fourth Friday Shabbats, and happy to share more information for anyone who chooses to reach out. We don't publicly put everything out there about locations for safety.
Yeah.
Thank you. What about you, Ben?
Yeah, you can find the podcast that I've been doing since April 1st, 2023 with Zach. Anywhere you find podcasts, just Google or just search. God, I hate that I just use Google that way. Just search The Jewish Diasporist. That's DIASPORIST, Diasporist, The Jewish Diasporist. You can also find our Instagram at The Jewish Diasporist Pod. We've been producing episodes more or less every other week for the last 2 years at this point. Pretty proud of the fact that we've been doing it for 2 years at this point. And we have a backlog of over 50 episodes that we've interviewed people from all over the world, from South Africa to Australia to Mexico to Israel-Palestine, of course, to really all over. And I could keep naming places, but let's not bother with that. Please just check us out. You can find us wherever you find your podcasts, really. You can also email us at contact@jewishdiasporist.com.
Thank you so much to both of you, Rabbi Chel Mandel, Ben Janowitz. It's been my great privilege and pleasure to learn so much from both of you, and I hope that you can return someday.
Yeah, and thank you for listening and asking the questions. It's important to share about Jewish community. We want people to know about what we're doing and who we are, and we don't want to just be within the Jewish community. We want to build connections and bridges to other communities. And this work's like really important. So appreciate the conversation.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for having us. And we hope we can come back at some point. It's really important that you platform alternative Jewish voices, because too many times people try to claim to speak for the whole Jewish community. And to be honest, there's nothing less Jewish than saying that you can speak for the whole Jewish community, because like two Jews, you'll have three opinions.
Amen.
We see. have taken.